costs that real people are incurring because of this crisis. And that is in the cost of, you know, I saw one woman post one test at her doctor for her 12-month-old baby that was $200, and it was not covered by insurance. That is, that, you know, multiply that by, you know, the multiple tests that any individual is going to have to take, the number of people in a family, the fact that on top of that, they might, you know, have to do soil testing and other things. There are real costs being incurred today, and somebody is going to be paying these bills. And I think ultimately that it, that the people who are experiencing this will be recompensated. I do worry that, you know, Bullseye Glass may become the poster child for the industry lobbyists and the, you know, strong corporate interests that have been in Salem fighting every step of the way to reform our air emissions regulations after they wrote them, you know, in 2000, 2003, between 2003 and 2007. After industry wrote those laws, they have been completely unwilling to budge in Salem about how we can reform them and how we can make them more protective of
Mary,
the communities that are next to these facilities.
We have to go now. I cannot thank you enough for this. This is incredibly interesting, incredibly enlightening. My guest has been Mary Pivetto. This has been Air Cascadia for Monday, February 29th, 2016. Kate Welsh engineered the show for us today. Thanks, Kate. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts. Know your rights. Take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned. Locus Focus coming right now.
This Tuesday at 8 a.m. on the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, a supporter of Hillary Clinton, Moses Ross, and a supporter of Bernie Sanders, Keisha Thomas, will join us and discuss their candidates' ideas. That's this Tuesday at 8 a.m. on the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show on KBOO, Portland.
Hey, do you know about the KBOO mobile app? Have KBOO at your fingertips anywhere you happen to be with our new mobile app. Look up KBOO in iTunes or Google Play to download the free KBOO mobile app. The app has many features, including listening controls in case you need to rewind back to something you missed and want to know what's happening on KBOO's Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram accounts. So you can find it all on the app, along with our community events calendar, newsletters, and more. The KBOO mobile app is the easiest way to connect with your favorite shows on your mobile phone. Download it from iTunes or Google Play today. And just to remind you, Locus Focus has a change in program today. The scheduled guest for today's show is ill, so we will hear an encore broadcast of an interview with Seattle biologist and gardener Anne Biclay and her husband David Montgomery, co-authors of The Hidden Half of Nature, The Microbial Roots of Life and Health. So you're going to want to stay tuned for that.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or WilkinCPAS.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. This morning, we continue the conversation with Seattle biologist and consummate gardener Anne Biclay, co-author of The Hidden Half of Nature, which we started during the Winter Pledge Drive. This time, we had the full show to take a whirlwind tour of the microbiology of soil in the human body. Plus, we're joined by Anne's husband and collaborator, David Montgomery. They will take us on an excursion through the strange and fascinating world of microbes, illuminating how discoveries of microbial allies in the soil and our bodies can revolutionize the way we grow and treat chronic diseases. Anne Beakley is a biologist and gardener who lives in Seattle, Washington, with her husband and collaborator, David Montgomery. Together, they are authors of The Hidden Half of Nature, The Microbial Roots of Life and Health. Anne and Dave, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Hello, Barbara. Glad to be back.
Yes, yeah, good to have you back, and it's good to meet you, Dave. And this time you're not getting on a plane.
Yes, it's very nice not to be doing that today.
And it's not flooding. It's better all around. Yeah. So I want to start by talking about what are microbes?
Sure. So microbes or microorganisms, whatever you prefer to call them, are simply life forms that are too small to see with the naked eye. So that includes, you know, everyone's familiar with bacteria and viruses. There's also another kind of a microbe called archaea. Fungi, surprisingly enough, are considered microbial. And there's also another category called protists. So that's things that are sort of like protozoans or paramecium.
So what's the distinction between these different categories?
The distinction is, well, interestingly enough, viruses technically are not really considered alive, but they get thrown in with all the other microbes by sheer size, and they are the tiniest of all of these groups. The bacteria and the archaea, we go into that. There's a chapter in the book that goes into sort of the story behind the microbe called the archaea. These are like bacteria, but they are also very different than bacteria. So readers who want to delve into that can check it out in the book. And the archaea, interestingly enough, they live in some of the most severe environments that we have on this planet, from places in Antarctica to deep sea vents in the ocean floor that are just incredibly hot places filled with metals. So their other name is sometimes an extremophile. And then, of course, you know, anyone who has ever looked at pond water through a microscope and has seen little organisms flitting around and moving, those are typically what we call the protists. And then fungi, everyone is familiar with those, I think, pretty much.
Interesting.
Mushrooms, slime molds, those, that sort of thing.
Interesting. With fungi, they're the ones that are probably the most visible to the naked eye. Because one of the attributes of microbial beings is that most of them are microscopic. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and part of the reason fungi are considered microbes is has to do with their cellular structure. I can't recall the exact detail right now, but I know that we were a little bit puzzled by that, but there is a reason for it.
So, what kind of role do microbes play in our lives? It seems that until recently. Even though scientists have been aware of them for a couple hundred years now, as far as the layperson, it's only been in maybe the last 10 or 15 years that I've heard a lot of conversation about the importance of microbes both in our bodies and in the soil. So what is the role that they've been playing throughout the course of time?
Yeah, you know, one of the things we were very fascinated with in researching this book was the way that people's perceptions of the microbial world has changed over time. Back in the 17th century, when a Dutch draper sort of first discovered microbes by accident, looking at a drop of pond water through a homemade microscope, you know, for a couple centuries, it was thought that, you know, what could something so small actually do that would really amount to much of anything? And then, of course, during the 19th century, when people started to realize that microbes were responsible for fermenting beer and fermenting wine, that all the booze in Europe was being made by little microbial assistants. And then when Louis Pasteur and Robert Koch worked out the idea that individual microbes were responsible for diseases, a whole new different take on microbes developed in terms of the way we perceive them as germs and things that were bad that could cause diseases. And it's really only been in the last couple decades that this whole new side of microbes has, and the relationship with the larger scale natural world that Anne, as a biologist, and I, as a geologist, study, has really come into focus. And that's through the beneficial relationships that plants and animals have forged with microbial life over the course of their evolution and over the course of their lifetimes. And it's that beneficial side that is really sort of a new lens on thinking about and looking at microbes and how their community structures actually can influence the health of plants and the health of people as we delve into and explore into the book. That perspective is really fairly new. We've known about microbes for a few centuries, but we're still discovering how little we actually know about some of the ways that they influence the world around us.
One of the things I was thinking about this morning, actually, as I was glancing through your book again, is that it seems that before we knew about microbes, that we actually lived in better harmony with them, both in terms of what we ate, what we ingested in our bodies, and how we treated our soil. And as we came to understand that microbes could cause all kinds of diseases, and we saw microbes as pathogens, that we divorced ourselves from the beneficial effects. I wonder if you can address how throughout all the many millennia of agriculture and of human health, that ways in which we lived in harmony with microbes.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation, Barbara. I'm not sure either of us have come up with that in quite that same way. Well, it helps a lot when you can't see something, because long ago, if you had a disease or an ailment that was either afflicting you or a plant, and you couldn't, literally put your finger on it, that also made it harder to, exterminate or kill it. So that, of course, has a duality to it, because, if you've got some dread disease, you obviously want to be able to treat that. But on the other hand, as soon as you start painting all microbes with that brush and think that they're all bad for us, then you get into trouble with that. I think the other thing, from an agricultural perspective, long before we had any agrochemicals, farmers were figuring out ways to either sort of beat the pests and pathogens at their own game, and so that was also something pretty different to what the approach is today. I think obviously that all really started to turn, especially with the advent in medicine of antibiotics around World War II. And then once World War II ended and the munitions factories were transferred into, other kinds of uses, fertilizers, and then even some of the wartime chemicals that were used in the wars got converted into agricultural uses. So it was sort of this story of taking some, wartime products and finding other uses for them that has sort of wrought some of the, some of the modern day poisons and chemicals that have gotten use in the agricultural world, at least.
Well, I was thinking, actually, one of the things that made me think about that, I was glancing through your book this morning, and you talk about in a glass of water that somebody would have drunk before the days of chlorinated water, before the days of municipal water systems even, that while you might get cholera from the water, but you also would be getting all these beneficial bacteria that are often not in city water systems anymore. And then the other thought that I was having was that farmers, before the advent of chemical agriculture, did a lot of observation. They might not have understood the role that microbes were playing in helping their plants thrive, but they would notice if they did this step, then the plants would do better than if they did another step. And so through observation and basically experimentation, figured out a lot of what had to be relearned in the 20th century in the guise of organic farming. So I wonder if that's what I was kind of thinking about the ways that people were more in tune in a way with microbes before we discovered them, without knowing that there were even were microbes.
Yeah, it's a very interesting idea, and I think it's fairly accurate in the sense that a lot of the science that's been coming online the last few decades in both the agriculture and the medical world has been it's providing mechanisms and understanding of how some of the connections from the microbial world to plants and to people actually work. And in the plant world, the idea that a soil filled with microbial life is actually disease suppressive is a fairly well-established, many times repeated experiment in agriculture. And a lot of the sort of traditional practices of intercropping with legumes and doing crop rotations that developed independently all around the world and were stuck with farmers because they worked, were essentially, in a way, sort of long-running trial-and-error experiments that led to practices that worked, but the underlying mechanisms, the why they worked, were not terribly well known, if indeed known at all. And one of the really interesting things about this new microbiome science in both the plant and the animal worlds is how understanding some of those connections is really sort of connecting the dots on why some of the arguments that some of the early proponents of organic agriculture, like Sir Albert Howard in England, made actually make sense. That at the time he was making the arguments about how mycorrhizal fungi helped nourish plants, the way that connection worked wasn't really understood, and he didn't gain a lot of traction in the scientific community. Now some of the recent discoveries are sort of backfilling in the mechanisms about why it was the practices he recommended, because he saw them work. Empirically, he would see that they would work for healthy crops and fertile soil. Now we're starting to be able to backfill why that actually is.
Well, we're going to find a little bit more about that coming up. Right now we're talking with Anne Beakley and Dave Montgomery, who are co-authors of The Hidden Half of Nature, The Microbial Roots of Life and Health. Before we get into more of a discussion of what you just sort of gave us a little teaser about, I wanted to just go back and talk about a little bit more about the importance that markups play in every part of life on Earth, starting with how we basically evolved from microbes. So I was really interested in the discussion in your book about the whole process that was called symbiogenesis, which countered a prevailing view at that time about how life was formed. And talk about the role that microbes played in creating the different life forms we have on Earth today.
Yeah, sure. It's a pretty fascinating story, actually. So you rewind the time clock and go way, 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 way back to the time before there was any multicellular life, and so there was just single-celled life forms in aquatic types of environments, water bodies of some sort or another. And if you're a single-celled organism and you're swimming around or you're stuck in place, sooner or later you're going to bump into another type of single-celled organism. And the hypothesis, the theory goes that two of these organisms bumped into each other, and then the unthinkable happened. One engulfed the other, and the one that was engulfed, it didn't die. It stayed alive inside of the one that ate it. And, indeed, there's a modern day, we ourselves are in a way kind of a modern day version of that, given how many microbes live inside of our bodies. But after that first merger happened, and it's thought that one of these organisms was probably sedentary and that the other one had the ability to swim, so it was mobile. But once those two joined, the mobile one, in a sense got wheels. It was able to move around, and the one that joined it probably got some kind of benefit out of the sedentary one. It might have been some kind of new food source or energy source. So then you fast forward in time again, and you've now got this sort of hybrid that's in existence, and then a third microbe joins it, and the thought is that it was probably some kind of microorganism that had the ability to live off of oxygen, because oxygen has not always been present on our planet.
Before that, they were living off of nitrogen, is that correct?
It's a little bit unclear. They were living off of some other kind of element that was not oxygen. It might have been sulfur. It's not completely known. So in any event, once the planet acquired oxygen, there were some microorganisms that evolved to live off of oxygen. One of these oxygen breathers joined the two-in-one job, And all of a sudden, you had a three-in-one that could move. It could use oxygen. And so it becomes this new kind of life form. You fast forward more forward in time, you know, yet again, and it looks like there were microorganisms. Well, let me back up that. The one that gained the ability to use oxygen later evolved into, much, much later, evolved into fungi and animals. And then plants came when there was a single-celled organism that had acquired the ability to photosynthesize, to take the energy from sunlight and turn that into an energy source. That joined this, you know, conglomeration of microbes, and that eventually led to plants. And there's evidence for this in two areas. That oxygen-breathing microorganism, the theory goes that today the mitochondria, which are sort of the powerhouses in the cells of every oxygen-breathing organism, those mitochondria are thought to be the descendants of that long-ago microbe. And then likewise in plants, the evidence is chloroplasts. These are these standalone organelles inside of a plant cell that are key to plants being able to photosynthesize. And so over several billion years is the time frame in which this started to when it ended and led to fungi, plants, animals, and then of course also the so-called, you know, lower multicellular organisms, things like the protozoans, because some of those are multicellular and are thought to be have come about in the same way.
So the fungi in the animal kingdom are much more closely related than the fungi in the plant kingdom, which I think comes as a surprise
yeah.
to a lot of people.
Yeah, that's exactly right, and it's pretty interesting.
Actually, I remember reading that. I think it was in Michael Pollan where he talked about fungi were actually animals, and I didn't get it at the time, but when I saw the description that you just had in your book, a light went on in my brain.
Yeah, and there's the one figure in the book that illustrates these mergers over time, which if a listener were to look at that, they'd go, oh, I see what they were talking about here.
So, by the way, if you want to get more information, this book is called The Hidden Half of Nature, The Microbial Roots of Life and Health. And it's for someone like me who never studied high school biology, it's a great introduction to biology. And then it takes you a lot further than anything you would have studied in high school. So I highly recommend this as an introduction to this whole world of microbiology in a very accessible way. Well, another thing that was interesting to me, I've understood, you know, the nitrogen fixing plants versus ones that don't fix nitrogen and the whole issue of why we need to have nitrogen in the soil. I didn't understand until I read your book why certain plants fix nitrogen. So let's talk a little bit about what creates nitrogen fixing ability in some plants.
Well, you know, we're bathed in nitrogen. The atmosphere is, what, 79% nitrogen or something. And so you would think that it was actually fairly easy for life forms to get nitrogen into their bodies. And nitrogen is one of those essential elements that's crucial for making, you know, amino acids and proteins. It's, you know, we need a bunch of nitrogen, and as do plants, sort of all life. But the nitrogen molecule that's in the atmosphere, that gas that we're bathed in, so it's N2, so it's a double bond of nitrogen, or it's a triple bond, actually. It's a double molecule, a triple bond. It's held together really tightly. It's hard to break apart, and yet you have to crack that molecule to get it into biological organisms. And it turns out that, as with so many things, there's a microbe that can do that. There's actually families of microbes that can do that. And plants have evolved partnerships with nitrogen-fixing microbes that live in and around their roots in a zone of the soil called the rhizosphere, which is right around the root system of a plant. And if you look back at the fossil record of plants back some 450, 500 million years ago when plants were first getting onto the continents, the first fossils we have of plants actually have mycorrhizal fungi wrapped around and intertwined with their roots. So these partnerships go like right back to the original colonization of the continents. And those microbial partners, the ones that can actually fix nitrogen, can inhabit special nodules that develop around the roots of plants, where the plants essentially invite the microbes inside, build them a house, feed them sugars that the plants manufacture through photosynthesis, and the microbes in turn essentially pump out nitrogen. They turn into little nitrogen factories for those plants. And the thinking is that most of the nitrogen that's in the biological world was essentially originally brought into plants via that mechanism. There's a little bit of nitrogen that turns into nitrate that organisms can take up through lightning strikes. And more recently, in the 20th century, we invented sort of industrialized ways to manufacture nitrogen-based fertilizers. But the long-term mechanism that nature's practiced has been to gradually crank out more and more nitrogen into the biological world through the action of the microbes that dwell in partnership with plant roots.
So why is it that only legumes and I guess maybe a couple other forms of plants have this ability to fix nitrogen? Most plants can't fix their own nitrogen.
Yeah, you know, I don't know the answer to that, but there's one of the things about the sort of history of evolution and geology is that it's a historically contingent science. And so it's kind of like that first random meeting of those two microbes that Anne was talking about merging to form a composite life form. That was an accident that happened that changed the course of the history of the planet. That one interaction sort of changed everything that happened downstream in time in the way that life evolved. And the legumes developing partnerships with rhizobial bacteria is another example of a kind of a partnership that once it's established was very successful and changed everything after that. You know, why every plant didn't develop that? Well, I think it's more, in my views, it's sort of more like miraculous that some plants actually did.
Well, I think it's probably fair to say, you have to talk to a plant biologist who studies the evolution of plants, but it could well be that the ancestors of the leguminous plants lived in environments that were poor in nitrogen. And so there just wasn't much nitrogen available in the soil naturally. So what better thing to do than to hook up with a microbe that can access all the nitrogen that's in a gas form in the atmosphere? And then, of course, once we came along and pulled these wild legumes out of nature and began to carry them around the world and domesticate them and turn them into crops, they never lost that nitrogen-fixing capability. You know, this is speculation on my part, but, you know, generally in biology, organisms are responding to things in their environment, and it's the reason they either have or do not have something or do something or do not do something.
So,
it's an interesting question.
So before we had chemical fertilizer, it seems that a common practice was to do crop rotation where you would have a field planted with legumes one season and then you would the next season plant alfalfa or hay or vegetables or whatever. Do you have any idea how this correlation was understood by early farmers that, in fact, not only did the legumes were they able to fix nitrogen, but it seems like they also left nitrogen in the soil for some other plant to enjoy?
Yeah, you know, those practices developed before people even knew there was nitrogen. So I think that they weren't so much thinking about the nitrogen aspects as much as they were finding that, oh, if you plant with legumes, it boosts the fertility. Your crop next year will be very healthy if you plant legumes in between, you know, multiple crops. And so it was, I think, observations in terms of what it actually did to promote the fertility of the soil that was the real sort of key there. The nitrogen-fixing characteristics of bacteria were only really discovered in the late 19th century by a couple of Germans, Hellriegel and Wilforth, who sort of figured out this microbial association with legume roots. So that came, the realization of sort of how it works came pretty late in the game. People realized for centuries, if not millennia before then, in different parts of the world, that interplanting legumes with your crops or rotating legumes into the crops was a way to maintain the health and fertility of the soil. So there's a long-standing body of sort of practical experience from farmers all over the world that pointed towards practices that helped improve the health and fertility, the tilth of the soil, if you will. And we're just now starting to get back to understanding how some of those connections, some of those practices, like cover cropping with legumes and like complex crop rotations that are starting to come back to the fore of agronomic research in terms of how they can work to help build soil health and maintain fertility. Because as we look forward another 100 years, we're going to have to really relearn how to maintain the health and fertility of our soils without as much reliance on chemical inputs and nitrogen inputs. If there's other ways to do it that we can foster, it's going to make a lot of difference to feeding the world with 10 or 11 billion people sometime after 2050.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Ann P. Clay and Dave Montgomery, who are authors of The Hidden Half of Nature, The Microbial Roots of Life and Health. Well, let's get now to what spurred you into this whole interest in microbes in the first place. Let's talk a little bit about the garden in your backyard.
Well, when we bought a house in North Seattle, it had a side yard that was a pretty much a bare lawn, and Ann wanted to turn it into a garden. She's a major league gardener, and really that was one of the attractions of the house until we dug into that side yard and realized that we had really very poor dirt. We had the kind of glacial till that is covers parts of North Seattle. Not really what you want to find as a gardener wanting to actually grow things in fertile soil.
So glacial till was left 10,000 years ago when the glaciers retreated from the Pacific Northwest. Is that correct? And in that time, in most places, it was transformed into a lot of humus. What happened to all the wonderful topsoil that permeates our region in your backyard?
Yeah, so when that glacier came down out of Canada, it sort of scraped the land clean and left till in its wake. The forest then came in over thousands of years and built up this really rich, very organic, rich soil that supported one of the most productive ecosystems in the planet, some of the temperate rainforest of the Northwest. And when Seattle was developed, they scraped that right back off to build the house because you don't want to build a house on a layer of organic matter that will settle. So they basically cleaned it back off just the way the glaciers had thousands of years before. And so we faced the problem of coming in a century after that and there being very little organic matter in the yard. There's very, very few worms, barely any life in the soil at all. And Ann started to bring organic matter back to the yard. She realized that our yard had plenty of the mineral part of soil, but we didn't have that other complement, the biological part, the living part, and the remains of once living organisms, organic matter. So she started bringing as much organic matter as she could find back to the yard. And over time, we watched that literally transform the soil in our yard and catalyze soil life that fostered life above ground, and we watched the progression of life coming back into our yard. And what was amazing to me as a geologist is that the order in which life came back was pretty much the same order in which life evolved on Earth. And that started us thinking of, oh, wait, there's something very fundamental going on here, the way ecosystems assemble from the microbial level of restarting the life that is breaking down organic matter and making that material available to be reassembled into the life that we see above ground. And we started to get very interested and started digging into that. And what really put me into the mode of thinking about microbes and thinking about their role in potentially restoring soils worldwide was how fast the practices Ann brought to our yard were rebuilding the soil. She built a couple inches of very fertile topsoil in about 5 years. That is very fast. It's much faster than nature can do it. If you can build a couple inches, in half a decade to a decade, you're outpacing nature by a factor of 10 to 100 to 1 at how fast soils naturally are built. And so the idea that you could actually restore soil fertility in very short order started to come into sharp focus for me, and that led us into looking into more into the microbial life, and then Ann had some health issues that made us turn our attention to looking at the parallel roles that microbes play in human health.
Well, actually, this, another light went on in my head when I was reading your book. My partner and I just finished a film about sustainable agriculture and food justice, and we interviewed Harry McCormick, who started Oregon Tilth a number of years ago, who lives in outside of Corvallis, and he was talking about this grass seed farm that he was working with to help them transition from growing grass seed to growing organic grains, and described how the soil had been, he called it, chemical to death, because the grass seed farmers in the Willamette Valley used to use immense amounts of pesticides and herbicides and chemical fertilizer. And he said that it's amazing, basically just through crop rotation and good practices and compost tea, how fast you can bring back the soil. And I didn't quite get it until I read your book. Why is it that you could bring the soil back so much faster than it would happen in nature?
Well, nature tends to work fairly slowly. And if you think about how the forest, say, at our lot, added organic matter to that yard, you'd have to grow, you know, take a few hundred years to grow a tree and then turn it over and cycle it a few times. We can actually manipulate organic matter inputs to the soil in much shorter order through, through crop rotations where you have high biomass producers that are then the crop residue is retained on the land and incorporated into the ground. The trick is to really kickstart the microbial life and to feed it with organic matter that it can break down and process. If you have a very rich life-filled soil, it'll break organic matter down a lot faster than if it doesn't have much. And one of the big problems with long-term fertilization has been shown to be that it tends to break down organic matter in the soil. So a lot of our efforts in the 20th century, if you look at it through sort of the thick, fuzzy glasses of a geologist looking back to the last half century or so, our efforts to prop up the fertility of soils that had been degraded because we had reduced the organic matter through long-term plowing, the situation we were in sort of the early to mid-20th century, long-term fertilizers that allow us to produce, you know, very abundant crops from those same degraded soils, but by adding the fertility. But part of the problem is that helped burn off the rest of the organic matter. And so we were drawing down the native fertility of our soils as we were trying to maintain their fertility. And so these practices that can actually rebuild organic matter and that can accelerate, that can basically rebuild soil fertility far faster than nature does, is really a function of the practices that we engage in on our farms or in our gardens. And just as people over millennia realized that there was advantages to including legumes and cover crops in their crop rotations, we're kind of relearning some of those same things at a large scale in terms of how those practices could be modernized, updated, and brought back in to farming to help us essentially kick the habit, if you will, of over-reliance on agrochemicals.
So what's the connection between the microbes in your garden and the microbes inside your body?
Yeah, I was just listening to Dave's answer to your question, and it made me think, actually, of that. And the reason for it is that so all of these microbes are sitting there in the soil, and they need organic matter if they're going to be able to live and to reproduce and to form, you know, the microbial communities that they do in the soil. And the very same thing is happening in our gut. We've got these indigenous communities of microbes that came to us, you know, in utero and via the birth process, and they need things to eat. And they have always thrived on different forms of organic matter. And just as in the soil where there are specific communities that will break down, say, a piece of wood versus a leaf versus, say, a rotten piece of fruit, there's different communities in our gut that will tackle the complex carbohydrates that plant foods are made from. And all of these plant foods are made of some kind of sugar molecule, and it's not a short little, you know, two-chain carbon molecule. It's a molecule that's got dozens of carbons linked together with other types of molecules attached, and that can take some work and some time to break down. And so really what you have going on is these similar processes of microbes. They're simply breaking down organic matter. And if we didn't have our gut microbes, we would be in a profoundly unhealthy state because we lack it's not just that we don't digest a good deal of the whole plant foods in our diet, we don't have the genes that code for the enzymes that do that work. But, you know, our onboard microbes do. So it's been this co-evolutionary process. And what's really another similarity, and this is where when Dave and I were doing the research, we went, this is, you know, sort of one of these way bigger picture fundamental patterns that we see, and it's this. If you take a look around the rhizosphere of a plant root, and you look very closely at what's going on in the lining of the colon, there's similarities. And as microbes are breaking down organic matter, they're excreting different kinds of waste products. And waste product is really a misnomer for some of these compounds and molecules, because in our bodies, they have absolutely medicinal effects. There's a whole class of compounds called short-chain fatty acids that microbes produce when they digest whole plant foods. And these short-chain fatty acids, they do everything from directly nourishing our colon cells to traveling in our bloodstream to other places in our body where they do other very beneficial things. And likewise, in the rhizosphere, you've got microbes that are they're living off of not only the sugars that are coming out of a plant's roots, but they're also breaking down organic matter, and the waste products that they excrete are of use to plants. In fact, some of these waste products produced in the rhizosphere, this is just wild, they're plant growth promoting hormones. So you've got these plants that are not even making the hormones that help them grow. They've sort of outsourced that job to the microbes, but because the microbes are right there next to the root, that hormone is that helps plants grow is very accessible. So those are sort of the fundamental parallels between the gut and the root and what's going on with the microbes in both of those environments.
So what are you going to be growing in your garden this year?
Well, actually, I want to get it. I'm thinking about this. I may just do, we may finish off the kale that's there now. I think I may pull those plants up, and I'm thinking of putting a cover crop in and actually just letting it go all through the summer, because I haven't done that in several years. And it's on my mind. I'm thinking, needing to give back to the soil and not just take. So I'm kind of toying around with that.
Sounds like a good idea. And maybe we'll have a wet summer, be really good for growing a cover crop.
Yeah.
Okay, well, it's really great talking with you guys. I really appreciate your book. Again, if you want to learn more about the microbiology of life, I recommend The Hidden Half of Nature, The Microbial Roots of Life and Health by my guests today, David R. Montgomery and Ann Beakley. And are you guys planning to do a follow-up on this at some point?
Well, yeah, Dave's got another book he's working on about sort of this whole new emerging world in farming that is not quite conventional, and it's not quite organic. I think he refers to it as organic-ish. And so it's a story of those farmers and some of the incredible things that they're doing.
Yeah, how fast they're actually able to restore their soil and how that may get us through the next century.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing that one and having you guys on again on Liquus Focus.
Yeah, and Barbara, I just wanted to say for listeners who, you know, want to know more about the book, just our website is dig, D-I-G, the number 2, and then grow, dig2grow.com. We've got a lot more information there. There's some microbiome-friendly recipes, I might add. And we're on Twitter, too, @dig2grow.
And we'll put a link to that on our website as well. So thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
I've been talking this morning with Ann Beakley and David Montgomery, who are co-authors of The Hidden Half of Nature, The Microbial Roots of Life and Health. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by The Incredible String Band. Thanks for listening.
And good morning. It is just a minute before 11 a.m. And coming up at 11 from the series Radio EcoShock, we hear scientist Peter Ward, who discusses catastrophism, the theory that extreme events determine the course of life more than the uniform process of evolution. And scientist Paul Beckwith looks at threats to plankton, which some studies show are as down by 40% since 1950. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the 26th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films from February 5th through March 5th. Most of the films will screen at Portland Community College Cascade Campus, and two films will show at the Hollywood Theater. The five-week-long festival of feature and documentary films come from all over the African continent and include Thursday evening documentary screenings, Family Film Day, and Women Filmmakers Week, held during the first week of March in celebration of Women's History Month. Again, that's 26th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films, playing Thursday through Saturday until March 5th. Most of the films will screen at Portland Community College Cascade Campus, 705 North Killingsworth Street, in the Arts and Humanities Building in Room 104. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Tune in to KBOO on Tuesday, March 8th, from midnight to midnight, as we celebrate International Women's Day with 24 hours of programming produced, hosted,